Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the arts hour, I interview guests from all areas of the arts, both local, national and international. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all my past shows there, and you can connect with me on social media, should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. And if you enjoy this interview today, you can tell your friends about it, go to the website and listen to the audio there, and also get links to my guest's website, photos, and information, etc. So this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Pulitzer Prize-winning author, journalist and prize-winning foreign correspondent Geraldine Brooks. Geraldine is the best-selling author of five novels, Year of Wonders, March, People of the Book, Caleb's Crossing and The Secret Chord, two non-fiction books, Foreign Correspondence, A Pen Pal's Journey from Down Under to All Over, and Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, and a collection of lectures entitled The Idea of Home. Geraldine's first novel, Year of Wonders, the story of a brave young woman during the plague in 17th century England, is an international bestseller and is described by Fry Gaillard as one of the first classics of the 21st century. Her novel, People of the Book, which traces the harrowing journey of the famed Sarajevo Haggadah, a beautifully illuminated Hebrew manuscript, through centuries of exile and war, is a New York Times bestseller translated into 20 languages. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2006 for her novel March, which animates the character of the absent father March from Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, crafting a powerful love story set against the backdrop of the Civil War. Caleb's Crossing is set in the 1660s and is based on a true story of the first Native American graduate from Harvard. Her non-fiction books draw on her time as a foreign correspondent. Nine Parts of Desire is a journey toward understanding the women behind the veils and has been described as an acute analysis of the world's fastest growing religion, which deftly illustrates how Islam's holiest texts have been misused to justify repression of women and how male pride and power have warped the original message of a once liberating faith. Her collection of lectures, The Idea of Home, reflects on what it means to be both a global citizen and a novelist at home in an increasingly fractured world. Geraldine grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney and attended Bethlehem College, Ashfield, and the University of Sydney. She worked as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald for 3 years as a feature writer with a special interest in environmental issues. In 1982, Geraldine won the Greg Shackleton Australian News Correspondent Scholarship to the Journalism Masters Program at Columbia University in New York City. Later, she worked for the Wall Street Journal, where she covered crises as a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. Geraldine is married to the author, Tony Horowitz, and they divide their time between homes in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, and Sydney, Australia, with their two sons. Geraldine's most recent novel is The Secret Chord, based on the life of King David. Welcome to the show, Geraldine.
It's fantastic to be with you, Ruth.
Well, thanks so much for giving your time to us. And I wanted to start off by asking you, I like to ask my guests this, if you can remember the first time that art of any kind had a deep effect on you, whether it was a book or a picture or music, when you realise that art has a power beyond just entertainment?
I can definitely isolate that memory, but I have to preface it by saying I didn't think of books as art because they were like the air we breathed in our house. We didn't have a lot of money growing up, but my parents were absolutely avid readers, and the trip to the library was like religious devotion. We did it every Saturday without fail on the bus, and my sister and I and my parents would all come back with our big stack of books. So I didn't think of books in a separate category in that way. It was food, you know, it was
right,
the
yes.
essence. But yeah. I remember my sister, who was 8 years older than I, took me to the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and I think I was about 9 or 10, and there was an exhibition of Rodin sculptures. And I remember just standing in front of those bronzes, gobsmacked at the beauty. There was the praying hands, and every of the hand, and the delicacy, and the implied devotion, and then the burghers of Calais. I didn't know the story of the burghers of Calais, but I could sense the courage and the desperation, and that a piece of metal could bring those feelings into your heart. It rocked my world, and I became an art history major as a result of that.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting way of putting it, talking about how, you know, like basically a lump of metal can evince such deep feelings. I mean, that is the amazing thing about art, isn't it? This sort of
It is. Yeah. It is. And, you know, it's just been such an enrichment to my life, and so much of what I write about, either directly or indirectly, is inspired by it, including, you know, I think the book about King David, my most recent book, because it was, as an art history major in college, with a special interest in late Renaissance and Mannerist and Baroque art, looking at all the different depictions of him and trying to imagine what kind of a guy could be both Caravaggio's street thug and Michelangelo's idealized man, and Donatello's rather effete boy man, you know. So all those different interpretations encapsulated in one person. And that's what art does, I think. It keeps turning the prism and letting the light shine in a different way.
Yes, yeah, that's a lovely way to put it. You say that books were like food in your house. Would you say you grew up in a creative environment then?
I don't think my parents would have thought of themselves that way, but in fact they were quite creative people. Mm. I think by the time I was born, it was more of the sort of quotidian struggle to get the food on the table because, as I say, you know, we were kind of a working class, lower middle class family, as many Australians in that post-World War II period were.
Yes.
And my dad had made his living as a singer, and so music was very important to him. And my mother just loved words, and she had been a radio presenter as a young woman. You know, it was funny because she had a very interrupted school life during the Depression. She was had to travel with her family as they went from town to town looking for work. And the nuns at her Catholic school, one nun once said to her, "Gloria, I don't know what will become of you because all you can do is talk and nobody will ever pay you to do that."
Little did she know.
Little did she know. And later in life, my mother reconnected with that lovely nun and she said, "Well, I could never have foreseen it, but there you go."
Yes, yeah, well, that's a great story. So you started out your writing career as a journalist. What attracted you to that form of writing initially?
Well, that was because my dad, when I was a child, was working as a proofreader on the Sydney newspaper. And I remember going to visit him when I was about 8. And it was just before the afternoon edition was about to go to press. And he took me down to the press floor. And it was tremendous, you know, just the smell of ink in the air and the rumbling as the presses rolled and this blur of newsprint flying across this vast space. And he reached out onto the conveyor and picked up a paper and handed to me. And it was warm. It was hot off the presses. And I remember looking down and reading those headlines and thinking, I'm the first person that knows what's going on this afternoon in my city.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be part of that. And so when I finished college, I applied for a cadetship at the Sydney Morning Herald and was lucky enough to be chosen.
Yeah. Being a journalist is one thing. Being a foreign correspondent is something else. You've said that you felt unqualified and terrified when asked to cover the Middle East by the Wall Street Journal.
Not initially. Initially, no? I just thought, wacko, the diddle-o. I've always wanted to adventure around the world. This is fantastic. It was only after I'd agreed to the job and then the reality of what I was supposed to do sank in that I realized that, you know, I had taken this huge leap, and I really, you know, it was the first year was just disastrous, to be blunt. You know, I was tearing my hair out trying to figure out what I was supposed to be doing and how to do it properly.
Yes, yeah. I know as a child you said you were painfully shy and also wanting risk and excitement, so your mother advised you to find out what you were afraid of and keep doing it. And I was thinking it must have been quite a gift to have a parent who could hold your difficult feelings and encourage you to work through challenges, because sadly many children don't experience that kind of emotional environment.
Oh, I know. My mother was fantastic, and you know, I try to emulate her and I don't do a good job of it, but she really had some kind of just magical knack for instilling confidence and just not being terribly tolerant of whininess, basically. you know, so it was very, very much, you know, get on there, get on with it. Realize everybody else is afraid too.
Yes.
That there's nobody out there that hasn't had the same feelings that you have.
Mm.
And just, you know, don't let yourself get in your own way. You know, this is a woman who let us play with sharp knives because she thought, well, you'll learn that they're sharp, and if you cut yourself once, you won't do it again. Whereas if you're overprotective in that way, the children will never learn where the limits are.
Yeah.
So we were pretty much free-range kids. The whole neighborhood was my backyard. I would go over the back fence and sit with the lady in the house over the back under the kitchen table while she got her sons off to school. You know, and then I just range around visiting people. It was a very free, fantastic life.
Yes, yeah. And being exposed to that kind of information, like everyone is afraid, I mean, is amazing, because it's so true. And if we all knew that, it would be so helpful, because we're all in our own little world, especially, you know, through your teen years, where you just think your problems are just, you know, the only in the world, you know.
I have a 13-year-old at the moment, and I wouldn't be back there for quids. You know,
no.
I remember that horrible feeling that the spotlight is on you and everybody is noticing everything about you, when the reality is everybody's worried about themselves.
Yes.
But you can't convey that to a 13-year-old.
No, it is hard, that's true. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, journalist and prize-winning foreign correspondent, Geraldine Brooks. And I want to let you know that she's going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on 19th of October at 7 p.m. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, journalist and prize-winning foreign correspondent Geraldine Brooks. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz there in the break, so just wanted to let you know again that Geraldine Brooks is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 19th of October at 7 p.m. talking about her new book and signing copies, I'm sure, and answering any burning questions you might have. So again, that's the 19th of October, Geraldine Brooks at Bookshop Santa Cruz. And before the break, Geraldine, we were talking about your career in journalism, and you quit quite abruptly. What was the motivating factor for you?
Well, it wasn't entirely abrupt. I'd been working for more than a decade as a foreign correspondent, and you know, it's fairly grueling work, and it's very unconducive to a domestic life. So I had a gradual sense of a ticking clock in terms of I would always be, you know, planting bulbs, and then when spring came and they were blooming, I'd be off covering some crisis somewhere, so I'd never actually seen my bulbs.
Yes.
And it's very taxing on friendships when people plan a dinner party around you and then you have to call from the airport to say you won't be there. Mm. And so, you know, it wasn't that abrupt, but there was a sort of clarifying moment when I was in Nigeria covering the dispute in the Niger Delta over Shell's fairly nefarious history of exploiting that region in cahoots with the then very brutal military dictator, Sani Abacha. Mm. And a lot of people had been arrested and brutalized because they'd been peacefully protesting against the situation of all their oil being taken and yet, you know, no money at all flowing back into the region. Yeah. And so I was there looking into allegations of military massacre, and you know, I collected a great deal of evidence, and then I went, as you do as a good journalist, to get the military side of the story, and instead they handed me over to the secret police.
Oh,
and they threw me in a lockup in a town called Port Harcourt. And I think it was on the second or third night, I was watching the malarial mosquitoes buzzing around the light bulb and thinking, how long are they going to keep me? And then I thought, I'm 39 years old. If they keep me for a couple of years, I will have missed the opportunity to have a kid. You know, it was sort of a I forgot to get pregnant moment.
Yes, yeah.
And so that was very clarifying. And when my son was born the following year, I realized that I didn't want to be going on long open-ended assignments to places where you could get thrown in the slammer and shot at anymore. I wanted to be at home,
yes,
as my mother had been. So I needed a different line of work.
Yes, yeah. So what initiated the move to telling fictional stories, writing novels?
Well, I wasn't at all sure that I could do it. It wasn't something I'd ever thought of doing. I really was committed to journalism. And so suddenly I thought, well, what can I do that is more in your own head than, you know, on long research trips? And there had been a story that I'd encountered 10 years earlier in England in the Peak District when I was rambling or hiking. You know, I like rambling. It's such a nicer word than hiking. Hiking sounds so arduous, but you know how it is in England with all the lovely old rights of way and footpaths through and between villages and through the countryside. And I was on a ramble and I saw a finger post pointing to a sign with the name of the town, Eme, and underneath it said Plague Village. And not many towns try to attract tourists by putting up signs saying Plague Village, but it worked for me. I immediately was intrigued. And when I got there in the parish church, they had a very moving display telling the story of what had happened in the village in 1665 when bubonic plague was carried from the big London outbreak to the town. And the town came together and took the unique decision to quarantine themselves voluntarily. And I had been thinking for 10 years about what that must have been like. And so I got a lovely prize for my second book of nonfiction, Nita Kibble Award in Australia, and it's an award to encourage women writers, and it comes with a nice amount of money, and I was extremely encouraged. And so I thought, I'll take this and buy some time and see if I can tell this story. And so I realized that it had to be fictional because the villagers were illiterate shepherds and lead miners, and they hadn't left any accounts of what it was like to live through this time. So you could only engage with it through an informed imagination. So I did the research as far as I could, and then I tried to hear the voices of the villagers. And luckily, one of them decided to speak to me, and she became the narrator of my first novel, Year of Wonders.
All your novels are based on some kind of source material, usually historical, although literary in the case of March. What attracts you to writing from a source rather than telling a story that's completely imagined?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. It's just that those are the ideas that grab a hold of my imagination. Something from the past where you can know a certain amount of intriguing information, but you can't know everything. So there has to be room for the imagination to work. But these stories where the voices have fallen silent, as in the case of Eme, or where you just know something that's quite remarkable. I always think about what Mark Twain said, that fiction must be plausible, truth needn't be.
Yes,
and I often think that if I made up the stories that I've written, that a Native American youth who was raised in his own language and culture on the island of Martha's Vineyard managed to learn Latin and Greek and sit down with the sons of the colonial Puritan elite and graduate from Harvard with them in 1665, if I had made him up, it wouldn't be very interesting.
No, that's
but
very
the fact
true.
That he actually lived and did that makes it fascinating, I think.
Yes. And why write it as fiction rather than non-fiction? Because there's the missing information and you want to be able to feel out and imagine what it could have been?
Exactly. I wouldn't do it if, for example, if Caleb Chase Teyamak had left a journal documenting what it was like to be him at Harvard in that time, then it would be a job for a narrative historian to make that story come alive. But he didn't, as far as we know, and there's very, very little known about him.
Yes.
And so in that void, the only way to tell the story is through imagination.
Yes, yeah. Former U.S. poet laureate Robert House has said, "It's hell writing and it's hell not writing. The only tolerable state is having just written." And you're currently in that state, having finished The Secret Court. I'm wondering how that feels and whether you agree with his sentiments.
You know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think writing is hell. I think having to work a metal press for 8 hours a day every day would be closer. I think we're very privileged, those of us who get to make art. And yes, obviously there are times of struggle, but it's nothing like the struggle of a lot of the people I covered as a journalist. So I think we have to get a bit real.
Yes. It's kind of a higher struggle, isn't it? Yes.
It's a different kind of struggle. But I think if you accept that most of what you do isn't going to be art, that there's a tremendous amount of mess making on the way.
Yes.
And just enjoy the mess making.
Yes.
I often say to myself, this is not the cure for cancer. Or nobody is waiting on a window ledge and they'll jump if I don't do this work today, you know. So I think there's a certain amount of self-importance that has come with, may I say it, the male artistic persona.
Uh-huh. That's a good point. For listeners who've not read The Secret Chord, would you tell them a bit about the basis of the story?
Well, this is
your
bit
new
of an
book.
Out,
yeah.
It's an outlier for me. Usually I am much closer to facts that are known and history that is documented, even though there are voids within that history. But in this case, I've taken a deep dive into that region where history and myth shimmer interchangeably. Mm. And it is a reimagining of the story of David, who was, of course, the shepherd, warrior, poet, biblical hero, also notorious adulterer, brutalizer, and murderer. So he's one of the great complex figures, and he's also the first political biography that we have of a human being from early childhood to extreme old age, predating Herodotus by half a millennium. So to me, that is so intriguing, and the fact that everything happens to this man, every human emotion from the best experiences to the very worst that you can imagine. Mm. So it's the most full life you can possibly envision, and it was wonderful to take the beautiful story as it exists in the books of Samuel. But it's a very abbreviated story. They cover so much in a sentence. It's a masterpiece of concision. So what I wanted to do was open the viewfinder and let some of the minor characters have more air, particularly the women in David's life.
Mm.
These women in the Old Testament don't usually do very well. We're lucky if they get a name, you know. So the women in David's story have names, and they have very distinct personalities, but they are there very briefly and only insofar as what they did affected the direction of David's rise to power. And I wanted to look at it from their point of view.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you this. The novel is set in a time that's beset by violence, a time of the dominator model, as feminist writer Rhianne Eisler would put it, where women are repressed and controlled. And I was wondering how important it was to you to flesh out the female characters, and also though what appealed to you about writing about this time that is such a male-dominated and violent era.
Well, you know, our own is not so different, really.
No.
I mean, we make these minor steps forward, but unfortunately, you know, if you think our time's not brutal, I just refer you to the latest ISIS video. We haven't changed that much. And I think it's important to keep interrogating this dark side of our species nature. You know, we really are a brutal species. And even the people who move the ball forward in some ways often have to do terrible things in order to affect that change.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose what I would say, I don't know that we're a brutal species. I mean, most men are not violent, but nearly all violence is committed by men. So there is a gender element to the violence throughout history and even today, that I just wondered if that's something that you're interested in.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that I would exonerate women entirely in this regard. I think that they haven't been required to do the kinds of things that men have been required to do for millennia. You know, until now, it was pretty unusual for a woman to be a warrior. But I think what we've learned from every single war is you never know if you're capable of an atrocity until is confronted with the opportunity to commit it.
I mean, I suppose what I would say, though, is that women have been in a position of being needed to be protected from violence that is coming from men. And so, you know, there is a situation where, yes, women weren't warriors, but that's because, you know, they needed men to protect them from men. But that's
But every time women have had power, they haven't exercised it that brilliantly. You know, women leaders are just as capable of brutality in their decision making, if not, you know, that with their bare hands.
Yes. We could probably talk about this for a long time, because I would argue that's partly because women feel they have to be like men if they get into positions of power.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, which women are prepared to make the kinds of compromises to get to that position too. So it's sort of self-selecting in that way.
Exactly, yes.
But I'm not a kind of dewy-eyed feminist who thinks that women are not capable of doing evil things, because history shows that that's certainly not the case.
Yes, no, I agree with you. Well, going back to the secret chord, I'm wondering about the process of weaving fact and fiction together, where you are dealing with a story where so much is unknown. How much is fact and how much is imagined? Do you even know? Or?
Well, no, how do we know? Because, you know, did David live? Outside of the pages of the Bible, there's very little evidence. You know, there's one stone inscription. There's nothing in the records of the surrounding sophisticated record-keeping societies that speak about him. So it's very much a literal leap of faith. But I'm inclined to agree with the British writer Duff Cooper that he must have existed, because no people would make up such a flawed character for a national hero.
Yes.
If you were making one up from whole cloth, you wouldn't make him an adulterer and a murderer. You know, you just wouldn't. So I believe that he existed. And then the question is, what did it mean to be a king in the Second Iron Age?
Yes.
When they say a palace, was it really a palace? So then you go back to the archaeological record, and you don't look at what was written down. You look at what was thrown in the trash, largely, which is what I love about archaeology, you know, because people are always saying one thing on paper, but how they actually lived is very, very much betrayed by what's in their trash heaps. And, you know, so I did spend a lot of time with archaeologists, with military historians, with students of ancient Hebrew music, to try and imagine what kind of, even we don't even know what kind of scale David might have played, what kind of harp did he play, and these kind of details, which is a lot of fun. And then to do the things that you can still do that haven't changed, which is, you know, sit on a hillside in Ein Gedi and watch the light change on the land, and realize that that was what he saw, and the smell of the herbs crushed under your feet, and what it's like to spend a whole day herding sheep on a hot, stony hillside. You know, those kind of experiential things. So I took my then 10-year-old son and did a lot of that.
Yes.
And that was very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there must be a daunting amount of research involved in writing a book like this. Indeed, all your novels. So I'm thinking you must have to be really interested in your subject to contemplate that.
Well, it is wonderful. And I love the research element. And I don't do the research separate from the writing. I let the story tell me what I need to go and find out. So I start writing, and then I have questions, and then I have to find the answers to them. Because I think if you do all the research first, the temptation to just cram it in and make the story fit what you found out, because it was so interesting, is very, very dangerous. And you can smell it a mile away in some historical works where the author has obviously just fallen in love with this thing that they found out, and it has to get in the book, whether it fits the story or not.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, Pulitzer Prize winning author, journalist, and prize winning foreign correspondent Geraldine Brooks. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe. It just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. Just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks. And for those of you who are local, I just want to remind you again that Geraldine is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 19th of October at 7 p.m. talking about her new book, The Secret Chord, answering questions, signing books, I'm sure. And if you're not local, then if you go to geraldinebrooks.com, I'm sure there's some information there about her national tour, and maybe you can catch her in another city. Before the break, we were talking somewhat about your process, Geraldine, and fellow Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jane Smiley, who is a previous guest on It's a Question of Balance, has described you as one of our most supple and insightful novelists. But I'm wondering, what are the criteria you want to meet when producing your work in order to feel creatively satisfied with it?
Oh, gosh, I think I'm always driven to write the kind of book I would want to read, really. And you can only really write for yourself because you never know about that fantastic, magical relationship between the writer and the reader. And I know myself as a reader that it's a almost undefinable relationship. You never know what you're going to get from a book. And you might get something completely different at one point in your life than you'll get if you pick it up again at another point in your life. You bring so much of yourself to that relationship. So I never presume on my readers, so I just use myself as the gauge, you know. If I'm intrigued with this, then I'll go forward. If I'm boring myself witless, I'll throw that in the bin and start over.
Sounds like a pretty good criteria. Even as a Pulitzer Prize winning author, you have received some reviews that are critical of your work.
I mean, oh, Flayed alive. I think there isn't a writer on earth who hasn't been flayed alive by somebody.
So, I mean, and I would say that, you know, all artists in all areas of the arts have to face that in one way or another. How do you process that sort of inevitable negativity?
I drink a bucket of gin and go back to bed. No, actually, you just have to get on with it. But it doesn't get easier. It's very tough, you know, and particularly now as the literary press shrinks and shrinks. If you get a negative review in one of the few, you know, book pages left standing, and it's always out there, and every time, you know, you come across it online, you have to read the same horrible topic sentence telling you that you suck. It's not easy, but it's part of the cost of doing business, really.
Yes, yeah, I guess. I have a master's degree in counselling, and one of the things that interests me in art is archetypes used consciously or unconsciously. And so I'm wondering, when you're considering a story, do you think on that level at all, how the characters are operating on a symbolic level as well as on a human level?
No, I don't. But I find it fascinating, you know, to go back later and see what you've actually done in that regard. Mm. I think when I'm writing, I'm in a almost stenographic relationship to the voice of the novel, so because I like to write in first person, and it's often unclear to me exactly who that person is until they start talking. And that voice in your head, you know, particularly in the recent book, my narrator is the prophet Nathan, who is the biblical character who has an unusual role in David's life, in that he makes his first big appearance to tell the king he sucks, basically. You know, he's the conscience of the king and the only person who can stand up and tell him the truth about his moral failings. And you would think that the career path for that guy would not be great. Mm. But intriguingly, it's Nathan who's there at the end when David is dying and he needs to arrange the succession so the right son will get on the throne.
Right.
And so he brought that voice of his conscience closer instead of pushing him away.
Yes.
And so that was intriguing to me. But I was thinking, well, that guy, to be able to get away with doing that, he must be such a fixer. He must be, you know, a Cromwell or a Dick Cheney, you know. And I was thinking of somebody kind of dark and a bit sinister. And then it turned out he didn't want to be that guy at all. He had an entirely different voice, and I had to listen to him. And what he wanted to be was the Hebrew prophet, who is the person that stands on the city walls and tells us all where we're falling down. And it's a kind of ethereal relationship poised between man and God. And channeling the divine, and that was who he insisted on being. And so I had to listen to him and write him in that way.
Yeah.
But I think we all are marinated in these archetypes. Certainly, you know, somebody like me who loved Homer and all the ancient Greek myths, just, you know, fed on them as a child. And so I think that they're very deeply embedded ideas in our Western society particularly.
I was intrigued in the book how they refer to the name. Can you tell us where that sort of came?
Well, that's really from the Jewish reluctance to speak the name of the divine. So in Jewish worship, you always say Adonai, the Lord, or Hashem. You never actually use God's name. And God's name is actually a series of unpronounceable consonants without vowels. But if you try to pronounce it, I think intriguingly, it's Yahweh. It's a breath. It's a breath. And I love this idea of God as the breath. The breath of the planet, the breath of our souls. And so I wanted to try and capture that by having my characters refer to him as the name.
Right, yeah. Well, that's interesting. And that sort of resonates with the Vedic idea of God as well. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Psychologist Alice Miller, who I love, writes at length about how art can help people process difficult events, whether they've experienced those events themselves or witnessed them. And I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect on both those making it and those experiencing it.
Absolutely. You know, I when I'm troubled, I write it out. And I've done that long before I was a novelist, just, you know, and I find that once it's on the page, it's not haunting me
right.
in the same way.
Yes, yeah.
So I think that that is true, and I'm sure that works for people whose medium is painting or carving or whatever it might be. But I also do believe that art works for people, and certainly, it was interesting to me. A friend had a horrible catastrophe in her life when I was working on The Secret Chord, and her son committed suicide.
Oh.
And she said that for months, the only thing she could bear to read were the Psalms.
Oh.
And I thought, well, if the Psalms really were written by David, as the Bible implies, then what an amazing thing that he is still ministering to somebody's suffering in that way.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think there definitely is some sort of energetic quality in art that communicates to us, you know, that's beyond, I don't know, our normal peripheral kind of experience of the world, definitely. I'm wondering, beyond the simple fact of story, as art is so much about communication, what you wish to communicate through your writing. Do you have an overarching message or theme that you're trying to explore through your work, or is each book a separate entity?
I used to say I didn't, because I, you know, I think it's for the reader to find what they need to find in the text, but I'm not sure I even believe myself anymore. And I did note that your program is about whether what unites us is greater than what divides us.
Yeah.
And if you wedged me in the door and said, what are your books about? I think that's what they're about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good way of looking at it. And also a way of intimately going into somebody else's experience, isn't it? In a way that's so different than in real life. Because when you just sit down with a book, like you said earlier, the book is nothing until the reader reads it. And that relationship is a sort of mystical thing, really, I think, as you read.
And I also think it's really unfortunate to despise the attempt at empathy. I think that there's a big debate going on right now about appropriation and who is entitled to tell whose stories. And it's very distressing to me to believe that we should have any kind of apartheid of imagination.
Yeah.
I think that the effort to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, even if it's flawed, even if it's imperfect, at least it's a start.
Yes.
on the business that we have to enact as human beings.
Yes.
And so, you know, you might argue that white privilege makes it easier for somebody to get published than the person of the group that white writer is writing about. But I also think that it can be, in a way, an opening of a door that, you know, the story imperfectly told will inspire somebody to tell it better.
Yes. Yeah. And as you say, I mean, it is an act of empathy in most cases. I mean, unless it's, you know, a cynical kind of approach. So I think there is a lot of value to that. Yeah. Winning the Pulitzer Prize is a huge deal in the writing world, and indeed outside it. It's very well known. And like awards in other areas of art, I imagine it could be a burden as well as a gift creatively, depending on one's character. How have you experienced it?
Oh, I would say there's nothing to complain about in getting the Pulitzer Prize. It's all good. It is all good. And, you know, for me, it was such a bolt out of the blue. I didn't, a friend actually called me to tell me that I had received it. I didn't believe him. I thought he'd been out to a long lunch and had me mixed up with E.L. Doctorow, who had a book called The March out the year that my book March. And I thought it was much more likely that Dr. O would have won than I would have. So I basically hung up on him. and so, you know, I think that it's very liberating, or it was for me. I just felt like that is the kind of affirmation that you can cling on to at your most insecure.
Right, yeah. Well, that says something about your character, because, of course, some people at their most insecure would feel like, I can never do it again. It was just a fluke. I'm a fraud. You know, I have interviewed other writers who sort of felt like they've written this one book and they're almost like a fraud because they can't write any others. Of course they do, but, you know, they're in that sort of battle. But it sounds like you're more well-balanced.
Well, I think, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to get up in the morning and say, oh, I have to write more beautifully today because yesterday I won a Pulitzer Prize? No, you can only write the book you're capable of writing.
Yeah.
And we all want to write better and improve and grow as artists. But, you know, the fact is you get up in the morning and you face the blinking cursor.
Yes.
And it's what we were saying earlier. There's just a tremendous amount of mess making on the way.
Yes. Yeah.
And it doesn't get less because you've got a nice little crystal thingy with Joseph Pulitzer on your windowsill, you know.
That's a very sensible approach. Just very briefly, finally, as we're at the end of the show, how much of yourself are you putting in your novels?
A lot. And I think, you know, it's probably not apparent to other people, but a tremendous amount of what I do as a fiction writer draws on what I did as a journalist.
Mm.
Even in the book about King David, The Secret Court, even in thinking about his wives, I thought so much about the women I'd covered as a reporter in the Middle East, in societies where women have no apparent public role and very few assured rights, but yet they manage to wield a great deal of private power. And I think people who disregard that will fundamentally misunderstand how those societies work. So I took what I'd learned among the women of Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the other diverse countries that I had covered and tried to apply that to the Second Iron Age.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Geraldine. We're looking forward, those of us here in Santa Cruz, to you coming here, and I'm sure everyone else around
me
the country.
it's going to be a lot more pleasant in Santa Cruz than it will be here presently in Massachusetts, so I'm looking forward to it too.
Well, thank you very much again for your time. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Ruth.
So just to remind listeners again, Bookshop Santa Cruz, 19th of October at 7 p.m. If you can head along, you'll be able to meet Geraldine in person and hear more about her book, The Secret Chord, and hopefully maybe even pick up a copy, which she will sign. And also, if you want to find out more information about Geraldine, you can go to her website, geraldinebrooks.com. And just to remind you also that if you want more information about the show, you can go to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. And as I said earlier, if you've enjoyed this interview, do tell your friends about it. If they go to the website, just click on the guest tab. There'll be a photo of Geraldine and you can click in and get all kinds of information, photos and the audio of this interview, which you can stream or download. Thanks for joining us, and I look forward to you being with me again next time.